This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Tomorrow, North Carolina will hold runoff elections in races that were too tight to call in the recent primaries. Among the most high-profile of these races are those in the 8th and 9th congressional districts. Primary elections bring out a much smaller number of voters than do general elections, and the turnout for runoffs is exponentially smaller. But they cost the state millions, and candidates have to find unbudgeted money to fund the runoff campaign. Many of the runoffs in North Carolina are the result of a state law that requires the winner in a primary to receive a substantial plurality. In this case, 40% of the vote plus one, instead of requiring a pure majority of votes. So here to talk about the election runoff process and some of the key races involved in them and the expense of all this are Michael Bitzer, Martha Kropf, and Jim Morrill. Dr. Bitzer is chair of the Department of History and Politics at Catawba College. Welcome back.
Morning. Good to be here.
Morning. Dr. Martha Kropf is Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for joining us again.
Sure. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. And Jim Morrill is the longtime political writer for the Charlotte Observer. Good to see you again as well.
Thanks, Mike.
Everybody is a returnee, so no explanation of the rules will be necessary here this morning. So explain this plurality versus majority law. In what elections in North Carolina does that apply?
Well, I think it applies to about every election except the nonpartisan school board race is the only exception I can think of. And it used to be 50% until the mid-80s. You had to win an absolute majority, 50% plus one. Mm-hmm. And then African Americans in particular complained that discriminated against them because a lot of times their candidates would win in the 40% range or high 30s and not get nominated. Mm-hmm. So they changed it in the mid-80s to 40% plus one.
So in the old days, if you had four or five people running in a primary, or six people in some cases, even more, if you didn't get at least 50%, you couldn't go on to the general election.
Right.
So this is actually a better thing. But has this caused more runoffs?
Well, the belief is that, you know, do you want a party nominee who only gets 30 or 35% of the vote? And, you know, with that, you've got 70, 65% that didn't vote for that particular candidate. So the belief was they need to get the substantial plurality in order to be the nominee.
That's all well and good until you don't get the substantial plurality and you have to go to a runoff election where a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of people turn out to vote. So would it not be accurate to say that the people elected tomorrow will be elected by fewer than a majority or a plurality of partisan voters?
5 to 8%, I think, is the estimate.
So isn't that worse?
Well, potentially, because it does, you know, cost the state $4 or $5 million to run the runoff elections. But I guess another belief is that it keeps sort of these outside candidates or the non-legitimate candidates off the ballot. It helps, you know, I mean, it helps prevent the power of some extreme minority candidate actually winning. So you say they have to have a majority or a substantial plurality, and it's supposed to help prevent that from happening.
But if 43% of the electorate were in this case, 38% of the electorate. Let's say that's the highest vote total that any candidate in a primary got is 38%. So they have to go to this runoff. If 38% of the electorate want this extremist candidate, haven't the people spoken versus taking that extremist candidate into another situation where only highly motivated partisans will come out and vote, a tiny number of them tomorrow?
Well, so what are we comparing that against, though? If we had just a system where they didn't have to get up to 40% or didn't have to get up to 50%, they've already passed one certain bar. I mean, in the 9th race, there was, 25%?
Pittenger got 32%, Pendergraph got 25%.
So they've already passed a certain bar to get to this point. Mm-hmm. It's just, and so those two are clearly the candidates that the public is most interested in. It's just that now we're going to have a few extreme people coming out.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding this. I'm going on what Jim Morrill said a second ago, and that is if the rationale behind this, and you used the African American vote as an example here, is that these people could not get elected because they could not achieve a majority. So that we back it off, so it's a plurality, 40% plus one, so that it's a fairer contest. What's fair about going to a runoff where a tiny percentage of voters make the final decision? What's fair about that?
Well, for one thing, I think that we're looking at a lower turnout tomorrow because of the timing of it. It doesn't necessarily – runoffs aren't necessarily a much lower turnout. I think in this case it will be because it's July 17th. People are at the beach. People are gone. Having said that, I think you still raise a good point. I mean, does it make it any more legitimate to have a majority of a 5% turnout than a 38 or 39% of a 30% turnout?
Yeah.
But the real question is, against what? I mean, I know that later on in the show we'll probably talk about some alternative mechanisms. But if the alternative is just saying someone has to just win a plurality, then, you know, we could have that extreme outside candidate. Instead of the two top vote getters that are going up against each other tomorrow. Now, admittedly, the non-beach goers are basically, or the beach goers are, only the non-beach goers are voting, I guess.
Unless they voted early.
Unless they voted early, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. So let's talk about the timing of this. Why is this in the middle of July? Why wasn't it like 2 weeks after the primary vote or 3 weeks after the primary vote?
Part of it has to do with overseas ballots and military officials that may reside in the state but want to potentially vote in this particular primary. They have to give them enough lead time to get the ballots overseas and for the ballots to come back. So that's part of the reasoning for the extension from May, the beginning of May, till now, the middle of July.
That's a federal requirement because if there hadn't been any congressional runoffs, then our state runoffs, the election would have been in June.
But this is pretty, I was going to say this is pretty late. So what you're saying is it's late because of the federal contest.
Yes, correct.
Okay. You were going to say.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's federal law, but even then, even if it was only state races, the overseas voters wouldn't have a chance to have their say. The military members that are in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. People who live, or civilian people who live in, say, Germany or overseas, they wouldn't get a chance to vote. The federal law says you have to have 45 days before an election to be able to get the ballot.
Now, this year there are a record 15 runoff elections in North Carolina. Why so many? Why is this the record year? It's like the temperature this year. What's going on?
Just the way that the votes happened. I mean, there are some that were very close to the 40% threshold, and there were others that were well below it. And it's just the other thing is that whoever comes in second can ask for the runoff. So there was one race, I think it was for auditor on the Republican side, that gentleman decided not to ask for it, even though he could have. So it's not just the plurality number, it's also whoever comes in second decides whether to ask for the runoff or not.
I think another reason was just the number of candidates. You had an unusually busy election year after filing. You had 10 candidates running in the 9th district. That guarantees a runoff. You had 5, I think, running in the 8th district. That almost guarantees a runoff. In some of these state races, too, some of the statewide races for council of state, you had multiple candidates running. And anytime you get that many candidates, you're almost assured a runoff.
Hmm. This means, obviously, that the state has to mount this extra election. And all over the state, there are more elections this year than there have been in the past. So we know what the bottom line is going to be, the cost of this election tomorrow to the state of North Carolina or to the municipality?
Don't they say usually $4 or $5 million?
I've seen anywhere from 7 to 8. You've got over 3,000 precincts in the state that are going to have to be open tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And you've got to staff them. You've got to.
Oh, no. They actually do get, $100 for a day of work.
Okay.
If you have to have 4 or 5, election judge of each party. The chief poll worker, the people to sign you in. I mean, after a while, it really mounts up.
The setup, the takedown.
Right.
Sure. I mean, a few fewer, but
So is this budgeted for in the state budget? Is this something that we plan for every year? So this is not a surprise to us.
No, I think they plan for it.
Yeah. Okay.
But
although
not
some
very well,
counties,
I think.
Yeah, some
I mean,
counties
the best they can,
are going to be pushing it.
So that
but
amount
they
of,
have limited money.
That amount of money that you mentioned a second ago is pale in comparison to the amount of money one would imagine that is being spent by candidates' campaigns to get you to come out tomorrow and vote for them. Is the most spending being done in the 8th and 9th congressional districts?
Well, yes and yes. The 8th district has the most outside spending of any district There's only two districts in the country where there have been more outside spending than in the 8th district. You're talking about $1.6 million, I think, at last count. Roughly half of that was from the Club for Growth on behalf of Scott Cadle, a Republican, and the rest is from other super PACs and sort of establishment PACs on behalf of Richard Hudson. The 9th district, you had Robert Pittenger, who spent about $2.1 million of his own money, about a million of that in the runoff. In fact, another $15,000 a few days ago. Nobody in the country, no congressional candidate has spent that much money of his own, his own pocket.
Now, you guys are political scientists. Explain to me why somebody would do that. Why is it so important to somebody to be the candidate from your district that you would spend that kind of your personal funds?
Yeah. Well, it's like that becomes the election. I mean, if it's given, first off, well, the 8th district, I mean, it's the way it was redistricted, it's mostly Republican. Mm-hmm. People smell blood among, Kissel, even though he sort of tried to lean to the right a little bit.
He's kind of a dino, isn't he?
I don't know. You know, ask Jim probably, but it sure seems like it in some ways, right?
Is that because of the redistricting, which has caused
he has to appeal to those people if he wants to be reelected. Republicans smell blood,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they think if they win that primary, they're almost assured, although I don't think it's assured. That's why there's so much money being spent of getting the seat, and the same for the
No, I understand why PACs and individuals will give money to a candidate's campaign because they want to see that candidate take their ideas and run with them in Washington. But I don't understand what makes it so important to an individual to win that they would put millions of their own personal fortune into the campaign. And what does that say about them, and should we be concerned about that? And not
personal
just in
ambition.
This district, but everywhere.
Personal ambition. I mean, they want to be in that position.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want it bad enough, they'll put literally their money where their mouth is. And
so is that a good thing?
And if they have the money,
why not?
Isn't that better
than some things they could spend their money on?
Yeah.
Look at it this way. I mean, Robert Pittenger, who's spending the money, is a Republican in the 9th district, which is a Republican district.
Mm-hmm.
If he wins the runoff and then goes on to win in November, he'll go to Washington, possibly in the majority party. And when you're in the majority in the House, you have a real chance to do some things. Now, he tried to do a lot of things in Raleigh when he was in the state Senate.
Couldn't.
And bumped his head against the wall repeatedly because it was controlled by Democrats. When you're in a Republican-controlled body, it's a lot different.
Now, I would think that despite the amount of money being spent in this runoff election that could have been spent in November or leading up to November, there's probably a silver lining in this, isn't it? Because most of these races are Republican races. They're not necessarily Democratic races. For instance, in the 9th, Jennifer Roberts is going to be the Democratic candidate. Nobody ran against her. She's the nominee, whereas she's going to face Pittenger or Pendergraf, whoever wins tomorrow. So they're taking money from November and moving it into July, aren't they?
Yes, but there will be no concerns about not having enough money come November. I mean, granted, a dollar you spend today, you can't spend it in November, but this election, particularly with the Citizens United effect, is going to have a tremendous amount of money coming in.
And I was going to get into the possible silver lining in all this, which we'll do when we come back because we have to take a break. Dr. Michael Bitzer, Dr. Mark the Kropf, and Jim Morrill with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Levine Children's Hospital, nationally recognized among U.S. News & World Report's top 50 best children's hospitals for neonatology care and five other specialties. CarolinasHealthcare.org/U.S. News. Increasing numbers of voters no longer identify themselves as Democratic or Republican, making independent voters increasingly important, as we are finding out in part this morning. In places like North Carolina, which is considered by some to be a swing state in the upcoming presidential election, it is these independent voters who are likely to decide the outcome. So who are they? What do they look like? Where do they live? And what do they want? We take a closer look at that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, New research on a rare gene mutation could offer clues about Alzheimer's disease. Another study could lead to early treatment. The latest on a disease expected to affect 10 million Americans by 2050.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about tomorrow's runoff, the cost of it, why we're doing it, the idea of having to have a plurality of the vote to win in the primary as opposed to a simple majority. We're joined by Dr. Michael Bitzer, chair of the Department of History and Politics at Catawba College in Salisbury, Dr. Martha Kropf, associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and Jim Morrill, longtime political writer for the Charlotte Observer. So all this money has been spent on these runoff races that will take place in North Carolina tomorrow, and I guess the silver lining in this could be, would it not, that all this money for television and radio ads that we've been barraged with has been focusing 100% of the attention on these candidates at the expense of the candidate from the other party that is not involved in a runoff. So these guys are getting a lot of attention and a lot of it's sinking in whether you don't like the advertising or not.
Well,
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say those advertisements are pretty negative, though.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, almost
all political advertising now is negative.
Well, a heck of a lot of it is. And I'll tell you, those super PACs, when they're coming in and they are spending money, they are taking a lot of the heavy lifting, doing a lot of the heavy lifting for the candidates. Because, I think the research has gone back and forth on what negative advertising does for the turnout.
Works. Because people still do it. I mean, it's obvious that it's having some kind of an effect. What the exact effect is, you know, whether it is demoralizing, you know, the attacked right. individual's base, or whether it's really energizing that base. You can't say that about my guy. I'll show you. I'll go out and vote. Mm-hmm. Or is it playing into the middle, just, you know, for those classic independent voters that are saying, you know, a pox on both parties. We're tired of this mudslinging. You know, that might depress turnout in that regard as well.
There's an old saying about, I don't care what you say as long as you say it.
And that's true, too. I mean,
it depends on how well, say, Jennifer Roberts does at building her name recognition, I suppose, although that
in
district, who knows? I mean, she has really great name recognition, but, I mean, it's a matter of do people even really – is she on anybody's
– radar?
I want to say radar screen, but that's a tough one because she's been around for so long, right?
The thing about the ninth and the negativism between Pittenger and Pendergraph is that some people, and I've heard this through kind of the grapevine, that if Pittenger gets the nomination, some Republicans may actually vote for Roberts because of the nastiness that Pittenger ran the campaign. I mean, he came out swinging against Pendergraph in particular, and now that it's gone to this battle between the two of them, there may be some people thinking, you know what, I'm not going to vote for this guy who has run such a negative campaign. I may switch and vote. It would be extraordinary, and I would still say the district's going to go Republican, but there may be some things going on.
Well, don't forget there is a Libertarian alternative, too, on the ballot in the fall for those any disgruntled Republicans. But you're right. I mean, the chances are that the party could be split, the Republican Party. I asked Jim Pendergraph the other day. I asked both candidates if they would support the other guy if he would win. And Pittenger said yes, he would support Pendergraph. Pendergraph said, "Ask me on the 18th." So that kind of goes to the question.
And I think one of the examples that we can point to was in 2010 when Harold Johnson and Tim DeNunzio in the 8th ran a very negative, polarizing campaign against both of them. And then what should have been a Tea Party insurgency, Larry Kissel survived. So that may be, you know, an example of what we could point to.
We may have already talked about this a little bit, but in a blog that Dr. Bitzer that you wrote about runoffs, you point out in states where winners in primaries are determined by first past the post, which means what? The first to get the most votes?
The guy that gets the most votes. Right. One more vote than the person who comes in second.
It is conceivable in those situations that the majority of voters could actually have voted against them, but they still win because they got the greatest number, perhaps as low as 35% of the votes cast.
Sure.
So does that make this system in North Carolina fairer?
Define fair. I mean, you know, is the mathematical number 40% plus one? Is it 50% plus one? I mean, that's the intricacies of running a democracy is you have all these ideals. You have all this great thinking about how the system should be run. Ultimately, you've got to implement and practice it. And that means drawing a line. Where is the line?
And you say that some believe that if the top vote getter doesn't secure the nomination in the first election, that candidate may be doomed in the second, especially if that candidate is the incumbent.
Yes, but the research has shown pretty much that 70% of whoever comes in first will win the runoff primary. So,
you know, I think a lot of this goes to the whole question of districts and how districts are gerrymandered across the board. You know, we always talk after city council elections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the city council districts are very stratified between the Republicans and Democrats. And so you have a Republican primary, for example, in a Republican district. And primaries and city races are notoriously low turnout. And so somebody might win with, you know, by a margin of 20 votes or something, you know, and with maybe 1 or 2% of all the voters in the district. And so how much of, you know, how democratic is that really?
Well, I saw, this could be wrong, because I just looked at this figure that I saw about the 2008 runoff elections in North Carolina, and I thought, this has got to be wrong. The voter turnout statewide, the number that I saw was 1.83%.
Yeah.
That's really right.
Yeah,
well,
in the runoff.
There was only one race.
Wasn't it Commissioner of Labor or something?
Yeah.
I mean,
so this
so
will
the
be
Democrats.
Bigger? This will be bigger because it's a bigger, they're bigger races.
There's a lot more races.
There's a lot more races. In addition to the 8th and the 9th, there's a runoff in the 11th congressional district in the mountains, and you've got some statewide offices that, you know, Republican lieutenant governor that's generating some energy and some enthusiasm. But, yeah, this is going to be – I would be shocked if it was in double digits in terms of voter turnout
what
statewide.
What was the primary like? What was the turnout like in the primary?
34,
okay.
35.
What would it be in a general election?
It'd be over 60.
Okay. Particularly for presidential.
Registered voters.
Presidential year especially.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Did you want to jump in there and say something? Or
I was going to say, I mean, and both parties have runoffs. There's the Commissioner of Labor for the Democrats is up, although I can't see that being a very exciting one yet again. But Republicans for the several Council of State positions have people. So, I mean, you're at least going to have just basically the Republicans turning out for the runoff. I guess they're not at the beach, or maybe they are. And not very many Democrats. So you already are cutting substantially what the potential electorate would be.
Yeah, and here in Mecklenburg, you've got the state Senate 41 Republican race that basically is going to determine who wins in November. We will have the election for that seat tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's no Democrat running against the Republican in that district.
Another reason for a low turnout tomorrow is that take the Republican primary in the 9th district. Republicans can vote in that. And unaffiliated voters who normally can vote in the Republican primary or Democratic primaries, only those unaffiliated voters who voted May 8th in the Republican primary.
And vote again.
And vote again. Some independents voted Democratic. They cannot vote Republican this time.
That's an important point, because I'll bet you a lot of independents out there might be going to, after seeing all this advertising, might be going to the polls to vote either for the person who could beat the Democratic candidate or the least offensive of the
two evils.
If they're smart enough.
They're going to get there tomorrow and find out they can't vote, right?
But Mike, if they're smart enough to do that sort of calculation in their head, they're probably smart enough to know that they can't vote in that race.
So is there a better way to do this kind of thing? Is there a better way than having runoffs?
Okay, so the big one that we have done with judicial contests, when there is a late when the judge, say, a vacancy at a peculiar time, I guess, not enough time to have a primary, we'll do instant runoff voting in North Carolina. And we've been doing that since 2006. And it was the last general election that we had our very first statewide instant runoff voting. They do it in a lot of cities all over the country.
Explain it. What is it?
Instant runoff voting is basically you get to vote on three candidates. You vote for, and in North Carolina anyway, for the judicial contest, they say specifically in the law, three candidates. You vote for your first choice. And if that person doesn't advance, you have a second choice. And if that person doesn't advance, you have a third choice. So it's like how they explained it when it was big a couple of years ago. They say you're pregnant and you send your husband to the store for ice cream. You say your first choice is cookie dough ice cream. If there's no cookie dough ice cream, I want chocolate ice cream. And if there's no chocolate ice cream at the store, I want Chunky Monkey.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically just saying, if this person advances, that's my first choice. But I might actually like the second choice candidate enough that I would vote for them in a regular runoff.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So then they count the number of first place, second place, third place choices?
No, they count the number of first choice places first. And if you get over a certain number, what,
then
40%, I think,
yeah.
A substantial plurality, then there's no need for the second or third choice.
Do you have to be pregnant to make this happen?
Yes, as kidding. A matter of fact, you do.
It helps.
Sorry, guys. I'm kidding.
Is this also,
we're disenfranchising not pregnant men.
Is this also what is called the two-round system that's used in places all over the world?
Ranked choice, I've heard it called. I don't know if I've ever heard. Is it called two-round voting? I've never heard that, but that doesn't mean it's not called that.
Now, there is something called top two. That is used in California and particularly in Louisiana, where basically everybody, regardless of party, runs in the primary election, the first election, and even if you get two Democrats, even if you get two Republicans, whoever the top two is, they then go to the general election.
We've already got one person hanging on the phone here and people chiming in online, so let me give out the phone numbers because this is obviously an election tomorrow. You may have some questions or comments. 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks, which I think covers all the other bases. John in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Two comments, Mike. The first comment is that with regard to the money that Pittenger has given to his campaign, that's a loan. And if he gets elected, there will be plenty of people wanting to give Congressman Pittenger money, and that money will come back. So I don't think we should call that money spent. I think we should call that money loaned.
It's an investment.
An investment. And the second thing is, I think that the 8th District is still, by a much smaller number, majority Democrat. I think the Republicans are close, but I think your comment was wrong. And I was trying to look that up on the Internet in between, but I believe the Democrats still hold the larger number, though there are a good number of independents in the 8th District also.
Jim?
Well, it may be on paper majority Democratic registered voters, but when you run the numbers, Republican candidates have do much better in the currently configured district than they did in the old 8th District. John McCain lost the old 8th District in 2008. If you plug in the numbers on the new 8th District, he would win by a substantial amount.
57%.
Yes, because of the loss of black precincts in Mecklenburg County.
Right. The current numbers from the State Board of Elections is that registered Democrats is about 46% in the 8th. Registered Republicans is 33%. Unaffiliated is about 21%. The trend, though, is when Republicans get to about 33 to 35% of registered voters in a district, that is when the district generally tends to flip. And in this new 8th congressional district, John McCain would have, if you laid over those numbers, would have won the district with 57% of the vote. In the old district, Barack Obama won it with 52%. 5%. So you've got a definite switch, and that doesn't necessarily mean that Larry Kissel, and I think all the decisions and the announcements that he's making recently, plays into this idea. Mm-hmm. He can win in that district. It is just an extremely uphill battle. I mean, Charlie Cook has this district as basically a lean Republican. Kissel is one of the most endangered Democrats in the nation.
Well, not only that, but Kissel has alienated a lot of African-American voters very recently with some of the recent votes and some of his comments about not endorsing President Obama.
Yeah.
In fact, last week, the African-American caucus in the district, which represents, you got to think a lot of voters there, came up with a write-in candidate, the mayor of a small town,
yep,
who's going to be their preferred write-in
candidate.
Yeah,
Larry Kissel has, as you say, has said he will not endorse President Obama for re-election. He's talking about not attending the Democratic convention here in Charlotte. He has voted with the Republicans on holding the Attorney General in contempt of Congress, and he has voted down the health care. He's voted
to repeal. Yeah.
Health care. Now, it could be said that he's just trying to save his own skin, and then if he gets reelected, he'll become a Democrat again or side with the president more often if he is reelected as president in November. But how does the party see this? Is the party going to support him knowing that he's in a tough position, or are they going to back away from him and let him just be free in the wind?
Well, one thing that's big, I think, that they think about is who is he going to vote for leadership?
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to, they're going to try and get a majority, whether the majority includes people who are, how did you put it, dinos, and,
mm-hmm,
right? They're going to want someone who's going to vote for their leadership.
They're going to support him. They are going to support him, and they may not, he may not be their favorite candidate,
right,
but they've already reserved about $1 million in airtime. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has they've made a point of saying that to emphasize.
Do you think they've had conversations behind the scenes? Like, here's what I have to do to survive, and if I survive, I'm still a Democrat?
If they are in any realistic chance of regaining the House, they have got to hold seats like the 8th, plus pick up another 25 somewhere. And, they can't sacrifice these kinds of districts,
mm-hmm,
just for, you don't vote with us. You vote with us 90% of the time. That remaining 10%, we're going to hold the grudge against you.
Right.
That's,
John, thank you for your call. Lawrence on the phone couldn't hold. He asked, will there ever be a movement to move voting to the weekend with more flexible hours for people who work?
Well, this is interesting because we are doing early voting in a lot more states in this country than we ever have before. And the thought was that convenience would make it so that people who couldn't vote during the regular week would, on a Tuesday after the first Monday in November would actually vote. But as it turns out, research study after research study, and maybe one exception, shows that early voting voters are pretty much the same as the people who vote on election day. So that is to say that people are voting, they're voting early because of convenience and not, they were going to vote anyway. So it's not bringing out new voters. Bottom line is you have a chance to vote on, weekdays. You have a chance to vote after work. You have many different chances to vote. You can vote by mail.
A lot of early voting is on the weekend.
So if you're
some
so
early voting, and they're sure as heck not going to put it just on Sundays because it's hard enough to get early voting.
So
on Sundays
if you're just looking for convenience, it already exists.
It already exists. Yeah.
And it's not increasing turnout.
And part of the thing about it, it is also a new campaign strategy. Obama used early voting in a way that we have rarely seen it utilized, because what he can do is bank those guaranteed Democrats and then focus more so on the swing voters.
Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Dr. Martha Kropp from UNC Charlotte, Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fisher & Phillips LLP, a national labor and employment law firm representing employers in North Carolina from Charlotte and Columbia offices. Partner Kevin Dalton and Fisher & Phillips on the web at laborlawyers.com. New research on a rare gene mutation could offer clues about Alzheimer's disease. Another study could lead to early treatment. The latest on a disease expected to affect 10 million Americans by 2050. That's the topic at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
The Democratic National Convention will bring crowds of protesters to the streets of uptown Charlotte. WFAE invites you to a public conversation on the First Amendment issues surrounding the demonstrations. This free community forum on politics in the streets is Thursday evening, July 26th at the Mint Museum uptown. Details and registration are at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here talking about tomorrow's runoff elections and the whole principle of runoff elections. And we'll get into the 8th and 9th congressional district races in a moment here with Jim Morrill, political writer for the Charlotte Observer, Dr. Martha Kropf, associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, the chair of the Department of History and Politics at Catawba College. A couple of web comments, from one from Perry. How much does it cost to file, and does this offset the cost of the election runoff at all? You don't have to file for the runoff. You're in it automatically, aren't you?
Yeah. If the person who comes in second asks for the runoff, then you're in it.
And but if 13 people ran for the race when they initially filed, there's pretty much guaranteed to be a runoff, one would think.
So, but
if you charged them a lot of money, it still wouldn't cover it.
And they don't charge them a lot of money.
No,
it's cost?
Based on a percentage of the salary.
A percentage of your salary as
elected official.
Really?
Yeah.
So what would that be?
Well, in local races, it's only a few hundred dollars.
Yeah.
A couple hundred dollars.
So it doesn't come anywhere close what it costs the state to do.
No.
Pebbles writes, in the 9th district, Republicans have 6 runoffs to the Democrats' 1. My husband, an independent, is not voting in the runoff. I told him he should write in Edwin Peacock III, but I don't think you can write in a candidate in a runoff. Can you?
That I don't think you can.
I would doubt it.
I'd be surprised.
I haven't seen the ballot. I haven't voted in the runoff yet.
Also, is it unusual that the Observer didn't endorse in the 9th yesterday? Or will they do that tomorrow?
Well, no. Let me caveat here. I can't speak for the editorial board, but they did endorse in the primary. They endorsed Jim Pendergraf, and then they unendorsed him, which they hardly have ever – they've never done, to my knowledge.
And they unendorsed him because –
They unendorsed him because that was in between the endorsement and the unendorsement. He made comments about the birther movement that he kind of supported or believed in.
Mm-hmm.
Questioned President Obama's birther.
Says that's why they haven't endorsed in the 9th again, because they don't have anybody to endorse?
I think there are some other factors, too, if you ask them. But, yes, they haven't.
Okay. And they won't, you don't think?
No, they won't. I mean, they came out yesterday with their endorsements in those races and some more today.
Would it be unusual for them not to explain the lack of endorsement?
They did explain it yesterday, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was, I believe they were concerned about Pittenger's amount of negative advertising and Pendergraf's, how can I put this politely, lack of real grasp on key federal issues, I think was the two concerns. Okay.
Well, in the 9th district, it's Republican Robert Pittenger up against Jim Pendergraf. Jim Pendergraf was what? He was the sheriff, and was he a county commissioner at some point?
He is a county commissioner,
excuse me.
Since 2010.
All right. Pittenger was obviously the lead vote getter in the primary, but he didn't have the plurality, the 40% plus one. So how much money has that cost him to date? Had he won, he would be up several million dollars, wouldn't he?
Well, yeah, he's spent $2.1 million, and I don't know whether, like the caller said, it was a loan. I don't know if it was a loan. I think some of it might have been just
Can you do that after the fact? Can you say, okay, I gave the campaign money, but that was a loan, so I'm going to take it back?
No, you've got to declare it as a loan.
Okay.
And I don't know that it was.
What about Jim Pendergraf? How much money has he spent? Does anybody
not
know?
That much.
He's raised about $350,000 and has spent about all of it. So, now, you know, in looking at individual contributions, mm-hmm. the two men are about equal. It's just the $2 million that Pittenger has pumped into it.
So does that put him at a distinct disadvantage?
Pendergraph?
Yeah.
Certainly. You know, the commercials that you see are almost exclusively Pittenger. Mm-hmm. Pendergraph has had to go on the radio. He's had to use Earn Media, the Observer, WFAE, other TV stations to try and get his word out. And, you know, if you turn on the local news from 5 till 7 o'clock, man, it's just all Pittenger, it seems like, all the time. But then there's the Cadle Hudson race that's factoring in.
We can talk about that, but not only does Pittenger have like a 7-to-1 financial advantage over Pendergraph, but there's also a super PAC, a pro-Pittenger super PAC that's contributed some money into the district, not a whole lot in comparison. It's like $25,000 at last look, but that's on top of everything else.
As a result of all the money being spent on commercials in these and other races, in this and other races, do we know anything more about these candidates than we knew before the primary? Have we learned anything new? Is anything that would be helpful to the voter coming out in these commercials, in this advertising? Mm-hmm. Or is it just all bashing?
Well, it is bashing. I think there are some ads that Pittenger is running that's kind of a mix, half and half. Half attack Pendergraph, the other half kind of support and frame Pittenger. You know, voters will get a sense of who these gentlemen are and potentially could learn some things about them. But, you know, that requires voters to be paying attention at this point.
Well, one of the ads that I've seen for Mr. Pittenger, I've seen it maybe, oh, I don't know, 10,000 times now.
only?
Paints,
you're not watching TV much, are you?
Paints Mr. Pendergraph as a moderate.
Yes.
And then the lady's voice gets very chipper when she says, yes. Robert Pittenger, conservative.
That's the
now,
dual split.
Given the increasing importance of the independent vote, is it a bad thing to be a moderate? Moderate has suddenly become the L word, liberal.
In a primary.
In a primary, yes.
That's who turns
really?
Out.
That's because who's going to be showing up? It's going to be the hardcore partisan voters that are going to want the true ideologue, the true believer. Mm-hmm. And if you can paint the other guy as this wishy-washy, he works with Democrats.
Used to be a Democrat.
Used to be a Democrat. You know, that's almost lethal in a Republican primary. I mean, look what happened to Richard Lugar in Indiana, who got bashed for daring to cross the aisle and work with Democrats.
All right, the two of you are political scientists. Talk to me about this mindset, because I don't think, I'd be wrong, I don't think it used to be this way. It's almost, I'm going to say something, I'm going on a limb here and say something I shouldn't say. It's almost ignorant.
It is.
And it would be the same whether you're a liberal or a conservative, and you respond to those key words as a liberal or you respond to them as a conservative, because it doesn't require you to think. It's a gut reaction.
Well, this is the nature of voting is that we've had a lot of partisan voting. You look at the biggest predictor of vote choice is typically partisanship. But what we're seeing now, and that's always – it's always been that way, but what we're seeing now is sort of this increasing polarization, I guess, is what some talking heads would say, pundits would, I guess I am a talking head right now, but that they would say.
And a pundit.
That this is happening. And with the Tea Party out there, you know, and this worry about the economy and this insecurity, it's pushing us toward more polarization, such that sometimes these key words, they do, you know, create a reaction, which is that you say, oh, Pendergraph used to be a Democrat. You don't say, oh, good, I'm glad he, you know, compromises, who maybe be able
or
to
I'm
compromise.
Or I'm glad he saw the light, if you're a Republican.
But he had to, you know, I mean, the thing is he had to make, well, no, they don't say that. They say he's a flip-flopper.
Yeah.
No. So then it makes him have to say something like, well, I don't believe Barack Obama is a citizen. You know, I mean, he has to say that to try and look like he's really more right than he was or used to be.
I'd agree with everything Martha said. The thing that I would point also is that the parties have become more ideological cohesive, particularly the Republicans. 60% of Republicans now say they are conservative. In the Democrats, it's about 40% liberals.
Is that the Tea Party wagging the dog?
I think there is some influence of that as well. And they have seen what they can do. They have exercised their power, the Tea Party has. Mm-hmm. And they have great influence in particularly North Carolina politics.
And who is the Tea Party? I mean, it started out as this grassroots organization of legitimate, of citizens who had legitimate beefs against taxation, and et cetera.
Big government.
Big government.
Yeah.
There's still
but
that.
Is it still that, or is it something that's become a wholly owned subsidiary of special interests who know how to make people go to the polls and approve their goals?
I think that the Republican elite have used it, and I don't think that's going out on a limb to say that then, and they've used it wisely, but I think there probably still are a lot of people with true beliefs that the government is getting too big, the debt is getting too big, that we can't spend any more money. But I really think that elites have really co-opted some of the movement, sure. part of the movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still a grassroots effort out there on the part of a lot of people who believe in the Constitution, who want to return to very limited government. But to a larger point about that you're talking about ads, you have to wonder about the efficacy of TV ads in a runoff where you're going to get 5% of the vote. Either one of these candidates tomorrow in both the 8th and the 9th districts, I mean, they're blanketing the TV airwaves. And yet you're talking about an election with 5%, 6, 7% turnout. So maybe that's 6,000 votes in a district that could win you the election. And how many of those people are motivated by the TV ads, and how many people are seeing those ads who aren't going to bother to vote at all?
There's a fellow named Charlie, I think it's Matissian. He writes for Politico. He says, if you're interested in better understanding the ongoing tensions between the GOP establishment and grassroots conservatives, North Carolina's 8th District GOP runoff is proving to be a revealing contest. And you wrote, Jim, an article in The Observer calling the 8th District ground zero in the GOP wars. How so?
Yeah, I don't know if that was my story, but
I thought it was.
But
it could have been David Perlmutter's story.
It could have been David's. Richard Hudson is supported by everybody, all the leadership PACs on Capitol Hill. Eric Cantor's PAC, he's a young gun. There's a super PAC called the YG Action Fund Young Gun, which is affiliated with Majority Leader Eric Cantor. He's gotten money from the Speaker's PAC, and he's in a former Hill staffer. His wife is still a Hill staffer in Washington. So you have sort of the establishment supporting him. On the other side, you have Scott Cadle, who's run in three different congressional districts now. This is his third. And he's got the support of the Club for Growth. And the Club for Growth is a group, a limited government group. And they've already got notches on their belt in Indiana, taking down Senator Lugar. They've had success in other races. So you can't underestimate them, and they're anti-establishment.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Hudson, if I'm not mistaken, was on Robin Hayes' staff, who lost to Larry Kissel in the 8th Congressional District several years ago. So is it better to be in that district? Is it better to be, and I guess Mr. Hudson would be the establishment candidate?
No.
So is it better to be the establishment candidate, or is it better to be the outsider candidate? I don't know that Mr. Cadle is a Tea Partier, but, I mean, he's not part of the Republican establishment in Washington.
He's
an outsider.
We'll find out tomorrow. I mean, there's a website called redstate.com, which is very influential among conservatives. And who's the guy that writes
it? Eric Erickson.
Eric Erickson. He's come out very strongly in favor of Cadle. So Cadle does have some Tea Party support, and so I think it'll be a test tomorrow.
Are they far apart on key issues?
No. They both hate Obamacare. They both want to cut the deficit. They both want, limited government regulations. I moderated a debate between them, and, they're basically on the same wavelength in terms of core conservative values. It's just that in terms of differentiating themselves, Hudson has gone after Cadle for stimulus money that he voted for, and has even gone to the point of changing the O in Scott Cadle's name on an ad to the Obama logo. And, that is just, it's subtle things, but, that's just, that's blasphemy amongst the true believers of the conservative movement. So it's a nasty race.
So in the ninth, where we have Robert Pittenger and Jim Pendergraf going up against each other tomorrow, how would you describe the difference in those two candidates and what they believe in and what they stand for and what they'll vote for when they get to Washington, if they get to Washington?
Well, I think they're both conservative, and you know, they both sounded very much alike during the campaign. I think Senator Pittenger has proven that he's very intense. He's very dogmatic about issues about smaller government, stuff that he worked for in Raleigh. I think he would do that. And I think Jim Pendergraf would be more of a congressman in the mold of Sue Myrick, which he admits that he would do.
And Myrick supports him. She's endorsed
yes.
him, right? Can we prognosticate here in the 8th and 9th?
If you believe
Do we have any polling data, first of all?
We don't have any polling data.
Okay,
and, you know, the track record has been for the person who came in first in the first primary, mm-hmm. 70% of the time they will win the runoff.
Okay.
So, you know, you've got to look at both Hudson and I think Pittenger as kind of the conventional wisdom lead. Okay. But when we talk about it, every vote counts and every vote matters. It's these kinds of elections that it's truly, this is the statement that we have to make.
And, of course, these candidates, whoever wins tomorrow, move on to November, and mm-hmm. they'll be up against Democrats, Larry Kissel and
Jennifer Roberts.
Who has the better chance in these contests? Does it really depend on who comes out tomorrow, or is it a foregone conclusion that in both races, the Republican, whoever it turns out being, is going to win?
Well, it's not foregone in the Kissel race, but I'm sure the pundits have said it leans Republican. The Roberts race, I think that's probably going to go Republican.
Mm. I think the Ninth District is very Republican. It'd be hard for anybody else to crack that. And the Eighth District, any chance Kissel has had, given that he's alienated some of his base on the Democratic side, I don't know that it's winning him a lot of votes from independents.
The only thing that I think could help Kissel is if Obama repeats the grassroots mobilization campaign he did in 2008 and get people to vote straight ticket.
Right.
That, I think, you know, punch Obama for president, punch Democrat for straight ticket. That's really a key benefit.
And
that's
too late for that.
And that's a conversation for the future because we are out of time. Dr. Michael Bitzer, Dr. Martha Croft, and Dr. Jim Morrill. I've promoted you.
Thank you
all for being here.